All right, welcome back to Beyond Sunday. We're exploring how to take our faith beyond Sunday morning. This is Patrick Nazaroff, and with me, as always, Pastor David Bowser.
How are we doing, Patrick?
You know, it's been a week, right? Like, yeah. We recorded last Thursday, mm-hmm. and here we are a week later, and the world is a very different place. 2020 is moving at a pace, man. It's
tough.
When things change, they change rapidly.
Sure. Yeah. You know, they often say that it's not the amount of change, it's the rate of change that really drives people, and it's how fast things change. And I think we're in that place right now, right? We've got everything seems to be hitting at once. We're starting hurricane season. We've got protests going on across the country. We're still not really sure what's going on with COVID. It's a weird time.
It sure is. It's a lot. I mean, it's a lot for any one person to digest. You could be watching the news 24/7 and miss things that are going on in our world. That's just an inevitability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which does not inspire me to watch the news.
Sure. But I'm sure, like most of our listeners, questions about race, racism, injustice, police, all these things have been circulating through our social media news feeds, whatever our news content we're watching, our conversations we're having with our friends and family, this is attached to it. Mm-hmm. We're either talking about it directly or not talking about it, which means we're saying something about it.
Yeah.
And so we here on Beyond Sunday did want to have a conversation. You know, mm-hmm. we felt like what's going on in our world is valuable. It's important for us to discuss. We're going to admit we can't possibly encapsulate every possible aspect of what's going on in our world right now in terms of race in a 45-minute show. Like, that's our episode. That's just impossible. Yeah.
We can't encapsulate everything that's going on within a 5-block radius of us right now in a 45-minute show. So,
Sure. Yeah. And so, and we also would definitely admit we're probably not the two best voices to have this conversation. We're both white, suburban people, you know, like males. Yeah. And so like we can say, we certainly have a perspective. I'm not saying like our voice doesn't matter in terms of the world, but it's just in terms of racism within the police system, I don't think I can really speak to that beyond hypothetically, in a sense, like beyond of, how can I address this with empathy and with understanding? But I can't get there on my own. Like, I just don't have that. Or what it's like to be black in America. I don't know. You know. Yeah. So,
well, one of the things I've seen time and time again, and you know, when I've heard things I've heard in training that I've had, and in you know, various classes and interactions I've had, is that listening is such an important place to start, mm-hmm. and such a oft forgotten art form. I think you and I both wanted to provide a space for not only ourselves, but also for our listeners to genuinely listen to someone's story and to get a perspective that perhaps we do not have on our own.
Yeah. Yeah, so we welcomed a member of our congregation, mm-hmm. Scott Mack, to come and share some of his experiences, kind of give his perspective on what's going on. A little behind podcast, we have recorded that conversation as we're talking right now. So we've already had that conversation.
Right.
And we're going to attach it there. I think Scott has some really insightful things to say. I mean, again, in even a 30-minute conversation with him, we can't get to everything. That's just an inevitability.
Yep.
We can't address everything. We can't get to every possible nuance or every possible question that our listeners would have. But it does start on a process of what we really wanted to do is listen and say, Scott, tell us about your experiences growing up. Tell us about how you perceive things right now. What are some steps we can take going forward? And so I think in a snapshot, it does give us a lot of good insight. But again, we can't cover every possible thing that you might have as a question or as a fear or as what you want to hear. We probably didn't get to everything. That's just an inevitability.
Yeah, we also recorded this podcast using a different software than we normally do. We don't want to name check any of these, but it rhymes with boom. So if the audio quality sounds a little different during the interview, that's what's going on there. This is an experiment for us, and so we'll see how it goes. But,
Yeah, so I think that I'm good. We can just go right to that interview.
Let's do it.
With Scott.
Put a little segue music here and we're ready to go.
No, I don't know if I'll put segue music here, but here we go.
Come on, Patrick. On
to our interview with Scott Mack.
All right, listeners, welcome back to Beyond Sunday. Patrick and I are here with Lord of Life Lutheran Church member Scott Mack. Scott's been a friend of mine for as long as I've been here at Lord of Life, which admittedly is not very long. But we also know that Scott and I discovered quickly that we have some connections back to the Carolinas from my time there and his time there as well. So Scott, welcome to the podcast. We are glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Scott, could you start just by telling us a little bit about who you are, where you grew up, what you do, whatever you think our listeners would need to know about you?
Well, I am, I grew up in, I was born in Philadelphia. I grew up in New York City. I joined the Navy when I was 19. So I'm a veteran. And I work now in surgery. I'm a surgical tech, vocation I picked up when I was in the Navy, and I've been doing it, 35, 40 years. A father of two children. I was an at-home dad for a few years. I love to sing.
There you go.
There you go. Yeah.
So you've been dealing with the COVID stuff kind of on the front lines as well. I know you've had some in the surgery environment, you've been working with that stuff.
Yes.
And so you've kind of had a lot of stuff thrown your way in the last couple of months here.
Yes, it's been a bit of a stressful, hectic time. A lot of changes all at once and just a lot going on.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, both work professionally and personally, of course.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, we're a podcast, so people don't have the benefit of seeing you like Patrick and I can see you right now. So we should probably just clarify for anybody who's out there listening in the interwebs, Patrick and I are both white and Scott, you are black. And one of the reasons we particularly wanted to bring your voice onto the podcast this week is because there is a lot of stuff. I don't even know the words to begin to describe some of it, right? There's just so much happening in the news around racial relations, blatant racisms, social structures that are permitting that or promoting that or are preventing people from expressing their displeasure with that. There's so much going on. And Patrick and I are aware that our voices are not necessarily the ones that can express the fullness or the depth of this experience. I certainly grew up in a suburban white neighborhood and have spent most of my life living in suburban white neighborhoods. I rely on the voices of people like yourself, Scott, people who have lived this, people who have walked these streets and walked in these shoes to share your story so that I can be better educated, so that I can hopefully live out a more just world for everybody. So if you could, what are some things that you think growing up as a black man or living as an adult black man in the United States, what are some things that you think are some unique experiences you've had that perhaps our listeners aren't aware of?
Well, there are several issues. Some of the things as an adult, and a lot of what's going on today has to do with, particularly with the interaction of the African-American community and the police force.
Yeah.
And so I have had, in my lifetime, numerous interactions with the police, starting when I was a young child. I remember in particular my first interaction with the police. My father was driving in a car. My two brothers were, the older brothers were with us, and the car broke down. And there was a service station not too far away, a few blocks away, and we had decided that we needed to push the car from where we were to the service station.
Yeah.
I was probably about six. I could barely remember see over the steering wheel because I was designated to steer the car. Uh-huh. My two brothers and my father pushed the car.
Right.
So we're making some progress and we're moving along, and a police car pulled up and they got out. And of course I thought, well, they're going to come help us push the car.
Sure. But they're the good guys. That's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah. No, what they did was they threw my brothers and my father up on the car and frisked them, interviewed them, decided that we had in fact not stolen the car that we were pushing to the gas station. And And still in my mind, I think, okay, now that they know it's that we haven't stolen the car, they're going to help us push it. No, they get in the car and they drive away, and we're still pushing the car. I'm still steering the car until we get to the gas station. So as a young boy, that's not a good first impression when the first time you interact with who you've been told are helpers.
Yeah. And so you were six, you said, when that happened.
About six.
Yeah, and you know, Patrick, you and I had this conversation a couple weeks ago where I shared, you know, my first memory of interacting with the police was at this kindergarten safety village camp that I went to, where it was like a week of learning how to cross the street safely, and a police officer came in at the end of the week and like reminded you to like stop at a crosswalk and things like that. Like that was my first interaction as a kid growing up in the suburbs, versus someone whose first interaction is, you know, these people that I've been told are going to help me did absolutely nothing to help me. And just literally left me on the side of the road to fend for myself. Yeah.
And not only didn't help, but you know, threw your dad and your brothers against the car and had the assumption, like the default assumption was something was criminal or something was amiss here, and not, it's just a family with a broke down car, which happens to everybody. And that's the default assumption that you experienced. And that's for David and I, that's just so different than the default assumption that we've, you know, experienced in our interactions with the police. So that's terrible. I'm really sorry. You know, that's and to experience that at six, that's a worldview going to shape, I'm sure, a lot of how your interactions with police are going to continue to go on. So please continue. Yeah.
Yes. And it continued on to when I was actually old enough to drive, and the numerous times that I've been stopped for driving while black.
And you know it
because you didn't violate any traffic laws. My plates weren't expired or anything else. I just got pulled over because I was, as I like to say, too dark for the neighborhood that I was driving in.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts with an interrogation. You know, what are you doing here? Who are you seeing? What address? But you know, all information that they really have no business asking.
Yeah.
But it's all based on the assumption that I'm not supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's frustrating. It's humiliating to be pulled to the side of the road by the cops and people driving by, and you know, you've done nothing wrong. But there's nothing you can do about it. And it's even more, it became even more disheartening when now I have children and they're in the car and we're being pulled over for driving while black.
Yeah.
And having to explain to them that this is, you know, what you have to look forward to, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know, Tyler is about to turn 23 and just got his driver's license last year. I think part of that delay was a fear of driving while black and being pulled over for it. You know, you have to balance instilling, you know, you don't want to instill so much fear that they're paralyzed, but you also want him to know how he has to interact with the police so that he can leave that interaction safely.
Yeah, so Scott, you and I have had this conversation before, but I'd love for us to be able to share it with some of our listeners. What does that conversation look like for you as a parent, raising your kids and teaching them how to interact safely, or how to best interact with the police? What does that conversation look like?
It looks like informing my children that the police are not necessarily on your side. Mm. That when they see you, they see a potential criminal from the start. And that is the basis that they're working from. So if you're driving a car and you get pulled over by the police, you need to keep your hands in view. You need to yes, sir, and no, sir, and not do anything that might provoke, you know, the situation to turn bad. And it's terrible that, you know, you have to put this onus on the children to behave in a certain way. And this is a conversation that I, you know, having spoken to you, David, and other white parents, that they wouldn't even conceive of having, but it's a necessary conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was learning to drive, right, the extent of the conversation about, you know, interacting with the police was, one, don't get pulled over. Because the assumption was you'd only get pulled over if you did something wrong, right? Exactly. So, so, you know, number one, don't get pulled over. And number two was, you know, be polite. That was the extent of it. Have your insurance readily available and be polite. You know, there was no sense of, you know, make sure this doesn't escalate, or make sure that you are overly polite, or, you know, make sure that you're keeping your hands in view at all time. You know, that was never a part of a conversation that I had growing up. And I honestly can't fathom what it's like having to have that conversation with your own 13, 14, 16 year old, right? That's, it's heartbreaking to think about that.
The nerve wracking thing is that it can escalate and they have no control. So you can do everything right in a situation, can still escalate because of perhaps the attitude of the police officer involved.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I mean, if I'm a little snippety towards the police officer, I just get a ticket. You know, that's what happens. It's like, that's what I get for having an attitude for your children and yourself. It's like, that's not a possibility, because that's not the worst case scenario. Right. Like that's not the, you know, you can't be frustrated to get pulled over because it could escalate so quickly, and you don't want to in any way add fuel to that fire, because you don't know how the interaction can what the depths of that interaction could possibly reach.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, and I think that's what we're seeing, right? We're seeing again and again the depths of what those interactions can reach, that they can get out of hand so quickly. And, you know, and what, in the past month, really? I mean, the story of Ahmad was come back, and we talked about that on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. Breonna Taylor, I want to get her name right. Taylor is coming back, and now George Floyd, right? I mean, these are names that are now known across the country that, for all intents and purposes, should not be known, right? And that's no offense to any of them as individuals, but these were not celebrities. These were not people who were seeking fame and fortune. These were people living their lives, and now they're a national figure.
And I think, you know, and maybe, you know, I don't want to speak over here, you Scott, here, but I think part of what makes this powerful or hard is the only reason we see movements of justice is because it's public, because there's video evidence that's going on social media. There are plenty of people that have died at the hands of the police or of white citizens that there was no video evidence of. Right. It didn't get on social media. It didn't circulate through our feeds. And so it didn't have a widespread attention. And then it just died. If George Floyd's video death was not recorded, would this officer be charged with second degree murder right now? And and in reality, we can say probably not. You know, like that's unlikely.
Was recorded, and he's barely been charged with that. I mean,
It took several days for that, and then in the case of Ahmad, it were weeks had passed before any arrests were made, and they were only made after the recording became public. The racial discrimination, the racism hasn't increased. What's increased is that it's being recorded, more people are seeing.
So and I like that point. I think that's a helpful reminder. Right, it's not that we are suddenly in an environment that is more racist. It's that racism is suddenly more visible because it's recorded, and it's been there all along. Yeah,
right. And that of course makes it that much harder for society as a whole to deny that it actually happens. It's easy when if I'm and my fellow African Americans are marching down the street and about an incident that happened in our neighborhood, if you didn't see it, it's not as important to you. If it didn't happen to you visually, it's not as important to you.
But I'm sure it'd be easier for white Americans to be like, well, it never happened to me. My interactions with the police were always positive. How is this different? And seeing a death like George Floyd's on video, it's undeniable. It's what happened was wrong. Like there's just no getting around that. And I think that's what's so powerful about this one instance, that it's kind of like, aside from a fringe, everybody's agreeing that was so wrong. And I think that is a powerful thing that we're finally getting a chance to say. In some ways, I get it better because of this video evidence.
And then some, you know, there are still some people that when a video comes out, the first thing out of their mouths is, well, you didn't see the whole video. You didn't know what led up to that. You didn't, you know, there are always excuses, you know, made, but this particular one, there were videos almost from the start of the interaction to George's death. And there's no excuse. You can't make an excuse for that one.
Yeah. Scott, I don't want to inappropriately date you, but it seems like you were probably born post civil rights movement and you grew up kind of in Philly, New York area. And so I'm sure that that was a part of your growing up, but I'm wondering what the current context feels like versus what you remember or what your family shared with you about life in the 60s and 70s, as far as people working towards justice or people advocating for change. You know, does this feel different? Does it feel more promising? Does it feel like just another dead end? What are you kind of feeling about this?
I think, I hate to sound pessimistic, but it's because it feels very familiar, which, you know, very similar to previous, you know, civil rights actions, which makes it seem like we're not making progress. You know, we're still fighting the same battles. We're still marching about the same things. Obviously, progress has been made. You know, I don't want to at all. You know, but in a very real sense, we're still fighting the same battles. And in that instance, it's kind of frustrating. I just last night on my Facebook post posted a couple of quotes from Dr. King's "I Have a Dream" speech, which was in 1963, and I quoted them because they are so appropriate still today, some 50 some odd years later. That shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be. We should have had 50 years of real progress and we shouldn't be still fighting these same battles.
You know, we've talked a lot about interactions with the police, and, you know, one thing that I think a lot of people will point to now, which is helpful in some ways, are the number of places across the United States where police are joining the ranks of protesters, if we want to say that. You know, I know here in Houston, the Houston Sheriff Acevedo, I believe is his name, marched alongside and kind of ensured safety for the protesters and for George Floyd's family, because his family is actually here in Houston. And in other places, we've seen police, you know, taking a knee with protesters, or we've seen police, you know, joining in marches, or I think in one place I even saw them, you know, shifting a protest to a police and community cookout where they were having conversations, And so I'm wondering, you know, what's the response? What's the response to someone who says, "Well, not all police are bad, right? You know, this was a bad cop, and that bad cop is he's charged with murder, and, you know, that's done, and we can move on." You know, because we do see police who are taking initiative to handle this in a better situation. So what's the response to someone who says, "Well, this is just one bad cop, and we can move on"?
I saw a quote that if you have 10,000 good cops and 6 bad cops, but the 10,000 good cops don't do anything about the 6 bad cops, you've got 10,006 bad cops.
That's like one of those little Facebook math problems that's been going around.
Exactly. And the point of that is that, you know, and I am encouraged by the cops interacting now with the community in a positive fashion and taking a knee and saying, "Look, we understand." What needs to happen, I think, from here on out is those good cops need to be good police themselves. You know, if they see a bad cop like the one in Minnesota or the 4 in Minnesota, instead of those other 3 just standing around, they need to say, "Stop this. You can't do this." They need to, because the public is not empowered to do so. So the only ones that can stop a bad cop are the good cops. They have to step up.
Yeah. And if Hollywood has taught us anything, it's that, cops don't necessarily want to do that. Now, I'm not saying we should take Hollywood for fact, sure. but that seems to be every cop movie that I've ever seen. No cop is going to turn against another. So, as we are, as individuals, continuing to interact with the world, and, some of us are able to or not able to join in protests in the way that we would like, or some of us are able or not able to be a part of a community movement in the way that we would like. What's kind of like one or two, maybe three things that you think everybody can do from their home to actually make a difference? Whether that's something they can read, something they can talk about, some way that they can change how they speak. I don't know. What do you think people can do to make a tangible difference in their own life that can actually make a difference in the community around them?
I've seen more recently there have been several books that are outlined. In fact, I'll get those titles to you that are specifically designed to teach basically the white community what can we do to help and how can we change our attitude. One of the things that has to happen, I think things have to happen on a personal basis before they can expand to, So this type of conversation like we're having here, and like I had the other day, at dinner with among friends, and we just sat around and we talked about racial issues and raising a black child and that kind of thing. Those things need to happen more often. Mm-hmm. I think we have a lot of superficial conversations, but I think we need to have them more in depth with people, with the communities of color, we need to talk about these things more often and feel comfortable talking about it. It's not a comfortable subject for anyone involved. So you have to kind of push past that and realize, okay, this is not going to be comfortable, but that's good. Being uncomfortable. If you're uncomfortable, then you're doing it right, I think.
I mean, I don't know how Patrick's experience has been, but, Scott, you and I are pretty good friends, and I still am uncomfortable having this conversation with you here, right? I mean, I'm the one who asked you to have this conversation, and yet I'm the one who feels uncomfortable like a schmo, because it's hard, right? And I'm am I going to say the wrong thing? Am I going to accidentally say something offensive? Am I going to, sound like an idiot, which are all probable? I think that we have to be willing to push ourselves to be uncomfortable, because if there's one thing this conversation has taught me, right, is that you and your children and others have lived their life uncomfortable, and I have not, right? For the most part, I have grown up very comfortable and have been in very comfortable situations, and so for me to be uncomfortable is not the end of the world. I can learn something from it, I hope that we can move together as a community from being a little bit uncomfortable.
Right.
And I think that's a call of Jesus too. And I don't think Jesus ever calls us to comfort. And I've probably said that about 1,000 times in sermons, that Jesus doesn't call us to a life of comfort. And yet here I am saying, I got to be uncomfortable.
Right.
A little preacher comes home to the mountain or something. I don't know. There's a question in there somewhere that I forget what it is, but.
Yeah.
It certainly is much, much easier said than done, but you do have to push past the discomfort and realize that it's an absolutely necessary conversation if we're going to move any further. I suspect that, I lamented the 50 plus years since Dr. King's speech and not as much progress as certainly I would like and most of us would like has happened. And I think a good deal of that has been not being able to push through the discomfort of these difficult conversations.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm sure, many of our listeners are part of the ELCA, so it's the whitest church in America, which we've addressed before on this thing.
Yep.
It's so I'm guessing most of our listeners are white. And so for me, watching what's happening, there are plenty of voices saying this was happening in the black community. Plenty of these things until this video. And then now it's come home to roost. But when, LeBron James is saying, hey, this is happening to the black community, and is told, shut up and dribble.
Right.
That is just dismissing it. And I'm sure it's dismissing by default all black voices and saying like, hey, stay in your lane. We don't want to hear this. Colin Kaepernick takes a knee. And it, now the issue becomes on, is this patriotic or not? Instead of the issues. And I think that's part of, the frustration, from my perspective of a black community, is saying like, we were telling you these things, and all the things the white communities or white voices were a lot of times saying was, yeah, but I don't like the way you're saying it. Right. And then, like, instead of saying, okay, we believe you and trust you. And now, and you know, we couldn't empathize until we saw it for ourselves. And so that's, I'm sure, frustrating, saying, this didn't have to get here.
Like, exactly.
Yeah.
And the phrase "all lives matter" is
a response
to Black Lives Matter, and it's a dismissive response. It's saying, you know, forget with that. Everybody matters. You know, it's like, well, you're not hearing us, and that is very frustrating.
Yeah. Saying Black Lives Matter does not deny the mattering of all lives, right? It does not deny that all lives matter.
Yeah.
It's that, hey, we have a sickness in a particular realm, and that needs to be addressed. And in order for all lives to matter, we need to acknowledge that we're not taking value in these lives.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Both of those statements are 100% true. Like, and one does, but by saying Black Lives Matter, I 100% with you here, Scott. All lives matter only diminishes that statement, and it does not hear the power behind it and the intent behind it, and that's what's so frustrating for I'm sure the Black community, and it's frustrating for people who want to try to find how can I be an ally to hear, and I'm sure that's part of when you talk about police need to police themselves, white America needs to police itself too, of saying, no, we're not going to fall on these defaults, or we're not going to fall on these things we've done and lived before. We can say Black Lives Matter proudly and boldly because they do, and for too long it has felt in our system that that's not been the case.
Right.
Yeah.
And so on a personal basis, I think what our white allies can do is to point out racism when you see it. Never, you know, in your water cooler conversations, when somebody makes a racist joke, call them out on it. If I call them out on it, I'm just the angry Black man. But if you call them out on it, then I think it maybe is heard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's heard more. I just think you have to learn to recognize instances or verbiage that might be racist or might be dismissive of an entire community. And when you see it, call it out. And I think because, you know, some people will do it on purpose, but some people might be completely unaware that they're being racist or that what they're saying is makes other people uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of learning to recognize those things and then calling out, educating them on what, you know, if you get the education and then you still do it, well, you know, then that's you. But if you're educated and you realize, oh, maybe I shouldn't have been doing that, or maybe I shouldn't have been saying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or it opens the door to further education.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, Scott, thank you so much for taking the time and for trusting us with your stories and for sharing those with our listeners. We deeply value your voice and your presence with us. So thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me. And thank you for discussing these uncomfortable subjects.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, all right. I'm hopeful that all that's going on in our world today means your children won't have to be on a podcast in 20, 30 years saying these same things that you're saying.
I hope so too.
I'm very hopeful for them, for our future as a country, that these things, these protests take root. They don't just slap a veneer on top of this, but that it's real system overall changes happen. I am hopeful and at the same time a realist, you know, like you know, like but I do appreciate this, Scott. I'm hopeful our listeners took a lot away from how we can be better allies to the Black community mm-hmm. and how we can listen better.
Yeah.
I hope so too.
All right, we'll be right back with more from Beyond Sunday.
All right, so that was our interview with Scott Mack.
Yeah. Thank you again, Scott, and we appreciate that.
Yes. I think did a great job of, even in like such a short amount of time, of like identifying the plight and the frustration of the Black community, what's going on right now, and also what we can do to help. Now, he did mention some books that he was going to get to us now. So we will be putting those on our Facebook page yep. and our website
yep,
when we get those books. Well, yeah. So we'll have those to you.
We'll and include those at in time the show of publishing, notes, yeah.
At time of publishing, we might have those.
Yeah, when we have them, we will get them to you.
Yes.
We don't have them right now. So
Right now, as we're right after the interview, we do not have them.
Here's what we can do. We can record us talking about the books and just leave little blanks where the titles would be.
Sure. And just superimpose them in there.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Fine. So any last thoughts on this topic here, Pastor David?
You know, I think Scott did a lot of great stuff in presenting things for us. I want to add mm-hmm. kind of a little bit of a biblical perspective for us to just a point.
Yeah.
We did Scott's interview this morning, and it's now early afternoon as we're talking. And in that period of time, I saw a couple things on Facebook that I think help frame some of this Black Lives Matter conversation, right? One thing that I saw was referring to the story of Jesus and the lost sheep, the parable of the lost sheep that Jesus tells. There's 100 sheep, one sheep is lost, shepherd goes after the one, 99 left in the back. And the reflection of this, right, was Jesus goes after the one that is lost. Jesus trusts that the 99 are okay, that they're protected and taken care of, but Jesus goes after the one that's lost.
Mm-hmm.
In a similar way to, I think, Black Lives Matter is trying to point out that there's one who's lost, right? That there is mm-hmm. one set of people who are lost, and to go out and find that does not deny the humanity or the security of the 99, right? The 99 mm-hmm. are still part of Jesus's flock. The 99 are still there, but they're safe. Jesus needs to go get the one, and I think this is a similar scenario. And I think we can look to the prodigal son as well, where you've got the two brothers, really the story mm-hmm. of the two brothers is probably a better way to describe this parable because it more fully encapsulates it. Mm-hmm. And you've got the dad who runs out to the brother who was lost, who comes back. And then you've got the older brother who's all grumpy and won't come into the party because his dad is rejoicing over this one who was mm-hmm. gone. And the dad says, look, you've always been my son. Right, everything that I have is yours. You've always been mine, but we've got to rejoice because this one who was gone or who was lost has been found. Mm-hmm. Again, in the same way, right? The dad is not denying the sonship of the son who stayed by celebrating the one who was lost. We are not denying the humanity or the sacredness of all lives by acknowledging the disparity that is being cast on lives of a certain race. And mm-hmm. I think that's what I want us to keep hearing, right? That Black Lives Matter, having this as a phrase that's in our vocabulary, as a way that we're experiencing the world, hearing that does not need to get our defenses up. Hearing that may make us uncomfortable, mm-hmm. but hearing that needs to help us be aware, not that our lives are being made less sacred or our lives are being threatened, but be made aware that there are people whose lives feel threatened and that we need mm-hmm. to be willing to listen, be willing to hear that story, and be willing to enter into dialogue with that conversation. And I think that's a biblical principle as well.
Oh, for 100%. That absolutely is. You know, a verse that like speaks to me during this time would be in Romans, Paul is saying like, rejoice mm-hmm. with those who rejoice and yeah. weep with those who weep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that that's a powerful thing. Like right now, a major segment of our country is weeping. And it doesn't say weep only if you really truly understand, or weep only if they're weeping the right way, or weep only if there's no looting going on or anything like that. It just says weep. And I think that that's a powerful thing for white America sometimes to say. It's like, I don't get fully racial inequality or how the Black community is treated by the police. I don't.
Right.
But I know that they are weeping over this. And part of my job as a Christian is to come to that place with some empathy and to weep alongside them.
Yeah.
And to say, even if I can't understand it fully, my heart can hurt with you.
Yeah.
Because that's, I think that is the calling of Jesus. Yeah. So, you know, when it comes to protesting over these things, I think we firmly can say, like, we believe in this. We think it's true. We think it's valuable. This doesn't necessarily mean, like, every act of, like, looting or lives lost in this protesting are things that we desire or think is fair or we want to have happen. And I'm going to say the vast majority of the protesters don't want those things either. Like, but we weep with the community that's weeping right now. And we support seeking the one that's lost or seeking the community that, that is lost. I think that's a powerful thing that we can stand by them with.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's probably worth us reiterating or maybe even making explicit, right? You know, we want to understand as best as we can. We want to understand the plight of the protesters. We want to stand with those who are weeping and share in their grief, to share that burden. We also want to acknowledge, right, a biblical understanding of this does not condone violence towards this. That I think there's a place for the Bible to stand and say, we absolutely need to seek and work for justice, and we absolutely do not need to do that through violence. And that's a fine line to walk, and it's easy for me to say that from the comfort of my office. Mm-hmm. But I think that's really important. And I think there's a place for Christians who are a part of these protests to actively step in and try to prevent that from escalating in places where it might. And I think we have been seeing that, right? I mean, I've been hearing stories out of, I don't want to say, you know, of my old home of Columbus, Ohio, of protesters putting themselves between between people who are being subjected to violence and the violence itself, so risking their own bodies to protect people and get people to safety. There was one story that a friend of mine shared of a car that took a wrong turn down a street that was being protested on, right? So it's suddenly in the midst of the protesters. The car was almost immediately surrounded by white protesters who were angry and beating on the car. Black protesters got the white driver out of the car, used their own body to protect this driver, and got the driver to safety while the car was being destroyed, right? Now, A, the car should not have been destroyed. But B, we have to remember who are the people who are putting themselves at risk in so many of these situations, and acknowledging, the violence was not the best action, is not the best course forward, but look closely at how we're handling these situations, and I think we'll learn a lot about one another and about where humanity can come into play. And sorry for the leaf blower that's in the background of my audio right now. If you as listeners get to hear, we have leaf blowers here in the Woodlands, Texas, too. We've got those.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to end this on as we close out, you know, a continued conversation. We may be coming back to this as a podcast. We're certainly coming back to this as individuals as we continue to talk about race in America, you know, how we can help help those who are weeping, help those that are afflicted, help the oppressed in any possible way. The Christian church has an obligation and command by God to do so.
Yeah.
And so I think that this is not the end of this discussion, that is for sure. So where can you find us?
Hey, if you liked what you heard today, or if you want more information, you can, of course, find us at www.beyondsundaypodcast.com, where you can find all of our episodes. As soon as we have them, we'll be posting the articles and the links that Scott mentioned in his interview. We'll get those up in the show notes. We'll also get those on our Facebook page. You can find us wherever fine podcasts are available for your listening pleasure, and we hope that you'll continue to help us spread the word about Beyond Sunday. So help share this with a friend or someone else that you think needs to be a part of this conversation, or someone who's looking to be a part of this conversation. We would love to welcome that part onto our Facebook page or wherever else you want to reach out to us.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back next week with more Beyond Sunday.